Today's Teisho will be on case 19 in the Book of Serenity, Yunnan's Sumeru. Introduction. I always admire the novel devices of Yunnan. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of a road? Try to discern. Case. A monk asked Yunnan, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunnan said, Mount Sumeru. Verse. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunnan's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony rooster crow can hardly fool me. I won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion. Well, this is the final day, I say, with some regret, with much regret, that this is the final day of our winter 2009 Sesshin. And I want to thank everybody for, again, sitting so beautifully this morning and for doing such an excellent job and having so much courage and determination. It's wonderful. I have to tell you the truth. I wish it wasn't ending. I do. I know that there's a strange silence in this room right now. when Genki Roshi said that when he was training at the Ryutakuji, his teacher Yamamoto Genpo Roshi was leading a sesshin, and Ryutakuji is really a training temple for people who are going to be Zen monks, and they will be probably leading their own Rinzai temples in Japan. And the idea is that these people should be deeply awake. So there's an element of boot camp to the whole thing. And the major training temples are Myoshinji, and there's another one also. But basically, Ryutakuji is like the smaller branch, but they also train. So anyway, at the one sesshin ended with Genpo Roshi saying, "Well, you know, I'm very disappointed. There weren't a lot of koans answered and very few kensho experiences. So we're going to have another week of sesshin." and Genki Roshi used to, when he'd tell that story, he'd roar with laughter and he'd say, "Boy, there were some kenshos then, you know." I guess Yamamoto Genpo Roshi thought that people weren't trying, they were just killing time. But in this case, that it's quite the opposite. Everybody has done a magnificent job, really magnificent. And so it's been a pure pleasure. And I saw those snowflakes and I did think, gosh, what if a blizzard hit? But alas, no blizzard. However, I do love sesshin. You know, I do love sesshin, and I'm very happy in sesshin. And I wouldn't have said that 34 years ago or 33, whatever it was, so many years ago. I would have been pretty happy to see the sesshin end, you know. wasn't the kind of person who would sit there and think all day on the last day, I can't wait to be out of here, you know. I guess I was happy to be at Sashini. But when it was over, it was like, phew, you know. You know, strangely, or maybe not so strangely, you know, the more you do this, the more enjoyable it becomes. And I think that has to do with the experience of a different way of being, you know. Normal life is whether we, normal life is rather small. It's built around the self and taking care of the self's needs and looking to the comfort of the self and the satisfactions of the self. And the whole world order is built on, today, is built on those ideals. You know, we spend billions and billions of dollars on, you know, all kinds of amusements and novel gizmos that nobody really needs and so on and so on. You can see that the value of the culture is, you know, taking care of the self and encouraging, you know, consumption and you know, basically pleasure-seeking behaviors. And there's nothing wrong with pleasure, but it actually leads to kind of like very shallow, I think, very small life, you know. Pretty much we're thinking about how to maximize our pleasure and minimize our pain, and how to make our dreams come true, right? Our dreams come true. These goals create, in my opinion, like a world of suffering, actually. You know, this is my opinion, and, you know, please understand that when I'm doing Taisho, you know, you're free to think, you're full of baloney, you know, you're free to think. This is not like, it's just my opinion, you know. The society is structured around these goals, and of course, it's very difficult, actually, to, fulfill the dream of total personal satisfaction, you know, actually, very difficult. It's very difficult, actually, to achieve the goal of, like, complete self-actualization, you know. These are very, in fact, I would say these are impossible, because desires proliferate. When you try to live a life that's based upon pleasure-seeking behaviors, you find that the craving escalates. It doesn't get to be, it's like you think, okay, if I have a piece of chocolate cake, I'll be satisfied, right? And indeed, you if you have a piece of chocolate cake, you might be satisfied at that moment, right? And by the way, there's nothing wrong with eating chocolate cake. This is like a metaphor, or I'm making a point, you know. It's just that when you create an object of desire, and then you create the means to satisfy that desire, and you satisfy that desire, it's not necessarily going to lead you to satisfaction, right? It tends to produce new forms of craving and new expectations. So if you have a really good cake, you know, you have a good cake and you think that was very satisfying, you think, but I wonder if there's a better cake, right? And then you try to find an even better. So maybe you made a chocolate cake with, you know, regular yellow cake inside, you know. And you can think, what if I made a pumpkin chocolate cake, you know, and so on and so on. So, I mean, I myself like to cook, you know, so I also say, well, what if we tried to make this kind of a soup? Wouldn't this be good? So I'm not saying that all pleasure is bad or that desire should be shunned, because that's actually impossible, right? But what I'm saying is that the values of our culture are one-sided, and they emphasize this the small self's quest for fulfillment, and they neglect other ways of living and being. And people, I think, are very unhappy often as a result, you know. And one part of this is that the life dedicated to pleasure seeking is inherently unsatisfactory, because you can never satisfy your desires. They multiply and transform themselves, like they mutate, you know. And so it's never enough. You know, my mother grew up in upstate New York, and I was thinking about how different her life is from my life, you know. My mother's family were basically dairy farmers, and my mother had no shoes in the summer. It's not like the end of the world. You know, they just couldn't afford shoes in the summer. You had like your school shoes, and that was it. And in the summer, people went barefoot, you know, because there wasn't, you know, you couldn't afford sneakers or something like that. And this wasn't a terrible thing, her reality must have been so different from mine, you know, because basically when I want shoes, I go over to like the shoe warehouse, and there's a million shoes, you know. And my mother, basically had like a pair of shoes to last until they fell apart. And I loved my mother, but she had very ugly feet. And one of the reasons her feet were so ugly was that her feet were actually like deformed from wearing shoes that were really too small for her feet. And that must have been painful, you know. So anyway, another thing she said was, she said that, you know, basically, when my grandfather used to go into Plattsburgh to buy groceries and things, he would sometimes bring back like a candy bar. Not like candy bars, but like a candy bar, and they'd like a Hershey's bar, and they'd break it up and each have a piece of chocolate. Or he'd bring back a couple of oranges. And this was like a miracle, right? It was like, oh my God. You know, so, I mean, you would think that getting off the farm and getting into our modern lifestyle with the shoe warehouse, I remember in Seattle, one of Webb Roshi's friends was a guy named Geshe Darge, who is dead now, but who was one of the leading teachers in the Tibetan Buddhist community, and in fact was a teacher of the Dalai Lama. And Geshe Darge said the first time he went into an American supermarket, he almost started crying because it was so stunning. You know, there's like a wall of oranges. And he said in Tibet, nobody ever has more than just enough to eat, right? He said in the Tibet he grew up in, you know, people weren't starving, but it wasn't like, I'm going to tuck into this food until I can't eat no more, you know. It was like, you know, it was like you had enough to keep alive, right, and modest amounts of everything, right? And he went into the supermarket, and he just said it was like another planet, right? You know, oranges piled to the sky, you know. And you would think that in that kind of you would think that modern people, you go around and say, are you happy? And you go, happy? Yeah, of course, you know. But actually, that's not the case, right? It's not the case. I remember reading this article. It took place in my wife's hometown, which is Albuquerque, New Mexico. And they interviewed a bunch of people from a place that is now part of Albuquerque, but it used to be a little town outside of Albuquerque called Martinez Town. And Martinez Town is a Hispanic community, and And they interviewed all these people who are like 90 years old. Apparently, a lot of people in town are very, very old. They've lived a long time. And they were interested in why these people have lived to be so old. And they all said, we had one, you know, they said, how was it back in 1920, you know, when you were young? And they said, oh, it was wonderful. They said, you know, it was great. You know, we were so happy. And you know, you could say, well, it's just in the haze of time. But again and again, they talk about the things that really meant something to them. And one of the things that meant something to them were human relationships. You know, they had deep human relationships. And they had a kind of emotional and psychological simplicity, right? I don't think that's the same thing as ignorance. You know, their lives weren't cluttered with so much illusion. And they said, you know, we had such a good time together. We enjoyed one another so much. And they said things like, there was a lot of love in our community. The other thing that was interesting was that they all said, we didn't have a dime. You know, we didn't have a dime. They would laugh about it. Like, I owned one pair of pants until I was, you know, I had a job, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, interestingly, those people had a culture very different from the modern culture. It wasn't about the adventures of the self on its quest for satisfaction and glory. It was about what? That's a big question, I think. But somehow their happiness had to do with not being part of that, I think, part of that quest, you know? So there's something about Zen practice which is a little bit like that, you know? Somebody came into Dokusan and talked about hearing a bird outside the Zendo yesterday, a bird. And how deeply moving that was, you know, how beautiful it was, and it triggered certain kinds of responses in the person. Now, the thing is, you know, most people just don't live in a world that would produce that kind of response to the sound of a bird. It just wouldn't, you know. I mean, mostly people are, they have things to accomplish. They're maximizing their pleasure and they're minimizing their pain. And they're preoccupied with all the things that go into those concerns. And basically, we've created a world of stunning complexity, right? And not an easy world to live in. Strangely, as we have become a more sophisticated society, it hasn't become a more particularly caring society, and it hasn't become an easier place to live, you know? So, you know, we're all just sort of like running around trying to survive, and of course, the mental state, the ordinary mental state is, trying to get from point A to point B, and meanwhile, living through all kinds of fantasies and having, you know, you'll see people in the car. I will be driving somewhere. I unfortunately do a lot of driving. And I've been waiting in line occasionally, and I've seen people like having an argument alone in their car, you know. So obviously they're like rehearsing some argument they're either going to go have, or they're listening to the radio and they're saying, no! You know, I disagree, blah, 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 you know. So this is like the normal consciousness, I think, of people. And when you come to a sesshin, it's like you step out of that collective reality, or so-called, I would say collective fantasy, and you begin to experience this very different way of living, you know, very different way, so that, you know, you could be deeply transformed by the sound of a bird. Now, you know, if you hear a bird and you're not deeply transformed, please don't try to be transformed by it, you know? And please don't feel envious, like you're missing something. Because if you just keep practicing, all kinds of wonderful things are going to happen. But you're in a very different consciousness from the consciousness that is the dominant reality outside of the Zen world. And it's a very I think wonderful experience of liberation to come here and go through this process. People can't get free from their illusions. That's the basic problem. You know, people have created an imaginary world, and they can't break free. It's like people who are caught. Have you ever had this experience where you're trapped in a dream, and something terrible is happening, and you know it's a dream? You begin to realize it's a dream, or you're hoping it's a dream. I actually had that dream just recently. It was like this. I realized that I was supposed to be teaching a course. This really happened to me. I realized I was supposed to be teaching a course, and I realized that I hadn't gone to meet my students the whole semester, right? You know, and I thought, you know, it was like, you know, I had this dream. I was in this dream, and I realized, my God, I haven't graded any of their papers. I haven't gone to the class. You know, I'm the director. You know, this is going to destroy my reputation or something like this. You know, my God, what a scandal! You know, I can't believe this is happening. You know, and then I thought, you know, it was sort of like it occurred to me. Well, hey, maybe this is a dream. You know. Really, I woke up and it was like, oh, thank God, you know, I'm going to grade those papers. I'm going to do a good job, I promise, you know. But that really happened, you know. That's like the classic anxiety dream, you know. See, because, you know, basically this last semester I wasn't teaching. I was on a leave from my teaching responsibilities so I could do something else. And obviously, I felt guilty about it, right? So anyway, I think that ordinary life is actually like that. It's very dreamlike, and it's like a dream you can't awaken from. And when the way people try to solve their problems is usually just getting them deeper and deeper into the same mindset that's causing them so much suffering, right? So it's like, if this attempt to maximize my pleasure and minimize my pain isn't working, I'll try another one. So life becomes like a maze with, you know, you're trying to get to your destination, and there's many branching doors, and you want to make the strategically best decision, right? And get to your goal, which is happiness. And of course there are people who sell happiness. You know, either they sell them. There are people who make millions of dollars going around telling other people how to be happy. You know, but when you come to Zen practice, when you come to a sesshin, you know, this is doing many things that are not apparently connected with maximizing your pleasure and minimizing your pain. You know, right? So you're getting up at 4:30 in the morning. Now, you know, I myself often get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So, at sesshin, I get up at 4, generally speaking, so I can get the tea ready and stuff like that. But it's not a big problem for me because I get up early. Now, if you generally get up around 8, you know, then getting up at 5 or 4:30 is murder, right? You know. So it's difficult. Honestly, I have come to sesshins where I get up at 4 o'clock and think, "Oh man, just 10 more minutes," you know. But fortunately, I came to this sesshin. I was pretty rested, and it's really not a problem to get up at 4 o'clock, you know. But I know from my past experience that, you know, it was at one time it was just like. It was like going to prison, you know, in a way, having to get up at 4:30, you know. It's just like, oh my God, you know, I'm going to be, you know, frog marched into the firing squad or something. You know, I felt very raw and, you know, because at that time I was getting up, I think, around the crack of 10, you know, something like that. And then we're sitting motionless, and your mind is intensely focused, and you have pain in your legs, and you're not moving, and you're pushing that pain away, and this would seem this is about as far in some ways from the dominant cultural values as you could get, right? The logical thing to do if you're in pain because you're sitting is to buy a more comfortable chair, right? That's what you should do, right? It's a simple solution. And so this goes against so many of the values of our culture. And yet, the strange thing is that by simplifying, by taking things away, and by simplifying, and actually by not pursuing, not trying to maximize our pleasure and minimize our discomfort, this strange thing happens. Life becomes intensely rich and alive, intensely. It might be a little bit like what those people in Martinez Town were trying to tell this young reporter. The interesting thing is that when you're trying to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, life becomes constantly threatening, right? Because any new event could cause you pain, or it could take away your pleasure. So life takes on a kind of paranoid character, where everything is your potential foe. Yeah, and it's like how to hold on to my precious advantage and not lose it. Every new event is a potential threat. So it's far from like producing peace, right? There's a constant instability, and it requires continuous vigilance. There's much to be said for having no future, believe it or not. Now, please don't think I'm saying quit your job and go on unemployment, because this is about how you live your life, right? How you go about living your life. One way to be intensely miserable, if you happen to be an artist, is to decide you're going to be a famous artist. Right? That's the most miserable possible life you could lead. Because if you think about it, there must be more than a million artists in the world. People who take art seriously, who consider themselves artists. How many of them are famous artists, right? It's not even a percent. So if your goal is to be a famous artist, it's like you've chosen the path of abject misery, right? It would be much better to love what you're doing because you love what you're doing. And it would be much better to have no expectations for or against anything. Yeah? This is, I think, like a superior way of life, where, there is actually, in a certain way, nothing to be gained and nothing to be lost, and in a certain way what torments us is the illusion that there's something to be gained or something to be lost, and we keep trying to correct the situation to make sure we win, and so we gain and we don't lose, okay? But we're constantly trying to win at the game of life. Let me say parenthetically that this has nothing to do with the koan, one gain and one loss. Really. So I'm not giving a hint about that koan. Okay. So let me go on. And this is a broader point. Okay. Buddha mind, what we call Buddha mind, is present here now. It is present whether you become fabulously wealthy or bankrupt. It's present whether you are in vibrant health or whether you are ill, sick unto death. You know, it's present whether you get your degree or you don't get your degree. This is so important to understand. There is a value to getting your degree, so please get your degree. There's a value to, you know, many things that people do, relative value. But in another sense, what is of greatest value is present whether you win or lose, whether you get it or don't get it. But now the small self hears this and is shrieking with, shrieking, right? You know, how dare you take my happiness away? Right? So please, you know, pursue your happiness, right? But it's not liberation. It's not liberation. It's not. I would say it's slavery. Right? Getting your degree is not slavery. But you could go after a degree in a way that would make it slavery. And how being an artist is not slavery, but you could turn it into slavery by trying to desire a particular outcome. I hope this is making some sense. And in fact, even Zen practice could be slavery, right? Because if you think, all right, I'm coming to Sesshin and darn it, I'm going to answer this koan, right? And you don't answer the koan, then of course you're abjectly miserable because you haven't answered the koan. But whatever is Buddha mind is present whether you answer the koan or not. And see, people find this so hard to believe, and yet every once in a while we hit a wall where we just can't break through. And then we let go. And it's heaven, right? It's heaven. You know? It's like our hopes are dashed, our dreams are smashed, you know, we're totally blocked. And it's like the worst, quote unquote, the worst thing that could happen. And then, you know, all of a sudden, it's a bigger world. That's the strangest thing, isn't it? But it's because you encounter this Buddha mind, if you want to call it that, that's present whether you answer the koan or you don't answer the koan. And Zen practice is, in a way, just going through this process of being put in a situation, you know, koan training puts you in a situation where it says, which is it, A or B? A or B, right? And you say, okay, if I answer A, you know, I pass the koan. So you go and I hope I might pass the koan. So you go into the teacher and you say, it's A. The teacher says, no. Then you say, then it must be B. You go into the teacher and the teacher says, no, it's not B. Right? This is the basic structure of the koan. I've given you the answer to all the koans now. The basic structure is that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Right? You know, the worst thing is to get your dreams. It's the worst thing, really. And you could say, "Well, I'll judge that when I get fulfill all my dreams." But you're never going to fulfill all your dreams, because as soon as you fulfill one, there's going to be three, and then three turns into nine, and so on. That's the way desire works, right? So basically, I'm not saying, you know, quit your job, but there's a way of living in the world which is beyond success and failure, beyond gain and loss. And it's like people have these experiences where they get killed and then they don't die, right? This happens, you know. Somebody will die on the operating table, or they'll be in an accident and they'll actually go into clinical death, or, you know, and then they'll be revived. So many of these people say, you know, oh my God, I realize life is so beautiful. The way I lived was so screwed up. really, this is quite common. You know, people will come say, you know, why did I care about this crap? You know, I just get up every day and it's a beautiful day. It's like they're already dead. You know, really. I mean, Zen is like being already dead. You know, and it's like my life is already over. You know, so I'm not expecting anything from life anymore. It's already over. Actually, that's what Dai Kensho is all about. They say great death, it's like dying. And psychologically, it's like, all right, my life is over. You know, but, you know, actually, imagine how cool it would be if you could die and then come back, you know. And so now you don't have to worry about bills. You don't have to worry about success or failure, right? Imagine, that would be so cool, right? Right? You know, basically, it would be great because nothing could hurt you anymore. You know, you wouldn't have to be afraid anymore. Wouldn't that be great? You know, so you know, what's keeping you from dying? You know, it's such a great way to live. Dying is such a great way to live. You know, it really is. But I know it sounds like a slogan. We should market that, right? You know, dying is a great way to live. That's a bumper sticker. But it says, try Zen. Dying is a great way to live. And then the phone number of the Zen. But actually, people come to Sesshin and do indeed die a little bit on the cushion, like that person who came into Dokusan. And we have a word for that, we call that Kensho. Right? I mean, you might think Kensho is this huge thing. It can be huge, it can be a little death, you know? But it's like you drop out of yourself, and when you drop out of yourself, the world just springs to life. And so this is like, there's a wonderful painting from Japan of skeletons dressed up in monk's robes, and they're dancing and they're having a party, and some of them are playing stringed instruments, you know, and this is, you know, this is the Zen life. It's like, you know, imagine if you could die and come back and now live in this world without any of these fears and anxieties, you know. Your life was over, so you're not going to be president, you're not going to be famous, those things don't matter to the dead, you know. And you can say, well, what kind of life is that, you know, to be a living dead person? But actually, being a living dead person is fantastic, right? It's fantastic. Because those things were never real anyway. You know, and if you're not worried about them, if your life is already over, then you can actually enjoy the moment. Yeah, being in the moment is so fantastic if you're not trying to become something. Yeah. So anyway, everybody has come here and died on the cushion a little bit, or is trying to die. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. A monk asked, it's very important to take good care of your body. Your body is like your sacred body, right? So your body doesn't really belong to you. In a political sense, it belongs to you. Right? Yes. In an ethical sense, it's yours, and so on. But in a certain sense, it doesn't really belong to you. It's something you need to take very good care of, right? When Confucius was dying, he showed his students his hands to show that there were no scars on his hands. And his point was, look at what good care I have taken of my body, right? So it's very important to treasure your body and take care of your health. So I'm not saying, you know, do harm to yourself or something like that. That's not what I'm talking about by dying on the cushion. I'm talking about breaking free from the small self and entering this bigger life. And usually that has to do with giving up on the search for anything other than what is always present, regardless of the circumstances. Buddha mind is right here now, whether you answered your koan or not. It's here whether you're healthy or you're sick. It's here whether you're having a good sit. So where, find it. Please find it. Because it's always here. Please find it. And monks at the Yunnan, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunnan said, Mount Sumeru. Mount Sumeru is like the biggest mountain in the universe, he said. The minute you begin to say, I want this outcome, you have created Mount Sumeru, a Mount Sumeru obstacle in front of you, right? The minute you're in deep mushin, you expect nothing, you anticipate nothing, you hear a bird, and it's a sound of the universe, right? The minute you say, I want, everything falls apart, everything falls away, and you're alone in the world again, and it's a dangerous place. So those are interesting choices, I think. So we all say, I want, right? And then there we are back in the hell realm. Every once in a while, it becomes intolerable enough, and we think, oh, I don't want to stay in this realm. I want to be in a different kind of place. And then you enter deep mushin, and wow, it's so beautiful. So please continue to enter deep mushin. We have some hours left. And there's a way also, let me just say, of being a self in mushin, right? I mean, there's a way of being a self which is not really being a self. That's true. You know, I mean, basically, you can take yourself very seriously, right? Or you can take yourself not so seriously, right? It's just like, this is just a game. This, you know, Kurt is just I just pick up my check, a check that says Kurt on it, right? You know? And that doesn't mean you don't respect yourself or care for yourself, but you don't take it so seriously, right? It's not such a big deal, you know? And we know that in a certain sense. You know, there's 6 billion humans on the planet. So how important could Kurt really be? Oh, very important, right? You know, but not, you know? 6 billion people. This is like 6, objectively speaking, small grain of sand. And that doesn't mean you don't try to find satisfying work or meet the right person in life, but there's a way of loosely inhabiting yourself, right? And not taking things so seriously. How do you know you're taking things too seriously? How do you know you're clinging to the self too much? Well, generally speaking, unhappiness is the sign of that. A fear and anger. So there's a way of dying on the cushion and being a self, which is a healthier alternative, I think. But the minute you say, I want this outcome, Mount Sumeru springs up before you as an obstacle. Or so I think. That's my opinion. Mm-hmm.